From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Typically, the airwaves at this point in the campaign season are awash with political ads, and with some close contests here in the Granite State this year, we've seen a lot of them, doing what these ads often do, cherry-pick certain facts and ignore others, stretch and bend the truth, and of course, get really creative with music, video, and photos. Here's a sampling of this year's ads.
Mary Linda Garcia has some strange ideas. Most people in New Hampshire want to raise the minimum wage. Garcia opposes it.
Scott Brown, not for New Hampshire. Never was, never will be.
Then Jean Shaheen went to Washington, where she has voted with President Obama 99% of the time.
Annie Custer wants higher taxes for you, but she didn't pay her own.
Today on The Exchange, we vet this year's political ads, why voters say they can't stand them, but campaigns feel they still work. And later in the hour, we survey the pollsters. Let's hear from you two this hour. How do you feel about political advertising this year? Do you find it annoying or amusing? Are there ads that hit home for you? Or do you disbelieve all of them? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement, which includes the New England College Polling Institute. Wayne, thanks a lot for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. My pleasure.
And joining us is Jonathan Van Fleet, managing editor for content at the Telegraph of Nashua and editor of PolitiFact New Hampshire, which has been checking on those ads all season. And Jonathan, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, every year it seems like people say, wow, there are more ads than ever. What do you think, Jonathan? Is that really the case this year?
I think it is. So there's, of course, a ton of ads from the candidates themselves. But these 2014 midterm elections have been dubbed by some as the dark money elections. So there's more money being spent by these outside groups, some of these shadow groups that don't need to disclose where their funding comes from, than ever before. The Center for Responsive Politics estimates about $1 billion is going to be spent on advertising from these dark money, these outside groups, these nonprofits that aren't your traditional political action committees.
So we have a couple players then. We've got the candidates themselves, right, Jonathan?
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got the parties like the, you know, Democratic Senate campaign committee. And then we have outside groups.
Yes.
And that's why it seems like there's so much. There's so many actors.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Wayne? More than ever or not?
I think so, too. And I think that you've got the three culprits. I mean, more and more, it's less about candidates running ads and more about other groups running ads. And that can be very confusing. Brady Carlson had a great piece. You can find it on the NHPR website from last Thursday, where the headline is more than 10,000, that's 10,000 television ads have aired so far in the Brown Shaheen Senate race alone. So, you know, in the article, if you read through it, one of the statistics they give is that Granite Staters, when they're watching television, can expect to see a political ad for this race every 6 to 7 minutes. And I know, as somebody who watches football on Sundays, I see a lot of these ads. So it is pretty remarkable.
Well, and Wayne, you know, we talk about TV ads, but, you know, what about other venues? I mean, some people just shut off the TV, but then, I don't know, on my music feed, for example, I've heard some ads. On YouTube, there are ads. I mean, where else are we seeing ads, Wayne?
Well, no, you're right. I mean, you really can't get away from them. I mean, whether it's in, you know, on your door, some folks have been canvassing your neighborhood and left literature on your, you know, on your doorknob, whether it's, you know, anywhere you surf online these days, it seems that there are pop-up ads. And preparing for today's show, I was looking at a YouTube clip and an ad popped up for Senator Shaheen, on the radio, in print. It really is pervasive. It makes folks long for sort of the British model where campaigns only last for 30 days. But we've been doing this for a while in New Hampshire this cycle, and it doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon. And I guess, Laura, the other thing is as these races get really close, we should expect a heck of a lot more ads. So I don't think the end is in sight just yet, but come November 4th, I think we'll all be breathing a sigh of relief.
We look forward to seeing those ads for washing machines and
paper towels.
Yeah. Don't forget good old-fashioned commercial radio. That's right. There has been a lot of advertising on commercial radio. What do you think, Jonathan? It isn't just the TV, although that's what most people complain about.
Sure. The other day I was thinking about it. I was driving into work, and it's my job to kind of know, follow these ads and all that stuff. And I had to admit I was completely lost. I had lost track of how many ads there were. And I was thinking about the average viewer, the average reader, the average listener. And I'm thinking, wow, gee, they just – their sense just must be it's a lot. And it is a lot. It is sometimes overwhelming, which is why PolitiFact is here to try and get into some of that stuff and give people some guidance. Because you hear completely divergent statements. One person will say, I'm 100% for this. And then the other one will say, he's 100% against it. And so which is it? We try and figure that out.
Well, I definitely want to spend some time this hour, Jonathan, picking into some of these ads, although we could be here for a month if we wanted to look at all of them. But picking up on what Jonathan said, Wayne L'Esperance, the idea of being overwhelmed, I do wonder at some level, there are so many that people just start to ignore it. I mean, do you reach a saturation point where people funding these ads are kind of wasting their money? What do you think?
Well, I think so, but I think here's the thing: you have to remember who are they targeting? Who are they trying to get a message through? And so, in some ways, that kind of encourages the more sensationalistic ads, the tougher ads, to try to break through what eventually, you know, for most people becomes just sort of noise. We look at the literature and it tells us that most folks don't start paying attention until political campaigns. The average person doesn't until after Labor Day, and you know, so the whole summer is kind of just put aside. And so at that point, there are only a few weeks, well, several weeks before the election, and candidates really want to try to break through. And the one way you do that is you go with as much ads, many ads as you can, and you try to make them as hard-hitting as possible to get people's attention. So this raises, you know, whether you go positive ads and negative ads, and I know we're going to get into all that. But I think your premise is right, that at some point, for a lot of folks, this is just noise. This is just, you know, it's something that's out there that they're not paying a whole lot of attention to. Until, you know, that ad that really gets everyone's attention and breaks through. I'm thinking of things like the Wendy Davis ad in Texas, which has got everyone talking about it, not for the virtue of the ad, but because of how controversial it has become.
We'll definitely want to dig into what it takes for an ad to break through, as you said, Wayne. But just on this theme, a little bit more of noise, here's a couple of Facebook comments from our listeners. Pete says, I don't notice them. Ads, especially political attack ads, have become like the hum the refrigerator makes or the ticking of the clock. When there's no pause or variation in the noise, you simply tune it out. Thanks for that Facebook comment, Pete. Here's another one from Heather. She says, I loathe them. I can't wait for this election to be over. Too much negativity, too much of literally trying to make your opponent seem ugly, finding the most unattractive pictures to use in the ads, too much similarity in style. Saw one today against Shaheen, then another immediately following for Custer, same style. Same approach, using a local female to explain why she is or is not supporting the candidate. Heather says, is it November 5th yet? Not yet, Heather, but thank you for the Facebook comment. So what does it take? I'll ask you first, I think, Wayne, for an ad to break through, as you say, through the noise that you've been talking about.
Well, I mean, you know, you would like it to be, you know, something positive, something maybe biographical. Somebody had some sort of distinguished service, or they're known for being an expert on a particular topic, and or maybe even a great idea that they have. But, you know, when you have 30 seconds to get a message across, unfortunately, the buys usually are on the more negative side, the grainy pictures, the you know, that somber voice, right? You know, that's trying to frighten you. Fear is an incredibly powerful tool in politics. So many of the ads out there are designed to scare you. You know, and we can come up with a lot of examples. One of the most famous ones of all, Laura, 1964, going way back, LBJ versus Barry Goldwater and the Daisy Girl ad, if you remember that. It ran one time. That ad ran one time, and we're all still talking about it, those of us who study this, because it was basically an ad that said, if you vote for the other guy, there's going to be a nuclear war and we're all going to die. I mean, that's as negative as it gets.
Wow.
And so you can fast forward, and you probably remember the It's 3 a.m. call, the call that the Hillary Clinton ad ran in the 2008 cycle.
Oh, right. It's 3 a.m. Who do you want to pick up the phone
right.
in an international crisis?
And so it's about creating fear. It's about making the other candidate, you know, an unacceptable choice. It's no longer really about differentiating on positions. If you want to break through, unfortunately, there's a lot of fear that's employed to try to do that.
Yeah, and it's a scary time, you know, Jonathan. We've got ISIS and other who knows what groups. We've got Ebola. What sorts of use of the fear issue have you seen in this year's advertising?
Well, the use of the fear. Okay, so there's been It goes across social issues. It goes across economic issues. We're going to raise your taxes. We're going to allow the NSA to spy on you. We are going to pay you less. We're going to take away women's reproductive rights. You name it, and it can be turned into a fear-based ad. And so a lot of voters, they don't have a stomach for some of this negativity, and they're tired of it. And the other day we were talking at the Telegraph with Jean Shaheen, and she said flatly, and I'll quote her, as political operatives will tell you, negative ads work. So in close races, sometimes the right negative ad can have a resonance with the voters and tip a race that is neck and neck in someone's favor.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the issue of privacy versus national security. And this hasn't been a huge issue this year in a lot of races, but it has been an issue, as you say, Jonathan, in the first congressional district. Let's hear an ad now where a Democratic group goes after Frank Ginta, saying he supports spying, basically.
Snooping on Americans. Frank Ginta allowed the NSA to do just that, to snoop on our private phone calls and to let government take our library records without a warrant. Frank Ginta even refused to stop bosses from demanding Facebook passwords. We can't trust him to protect our privacy. Carol Shea Porter, an independent voice who stood up...
So there we have an ad in the 1st Congressional District, Jonathan, talking about the NSA. It's interesting that this has come up in this particular race.
Mm-hmm. Nobody wants the NSA spying on them. And so, therefore, this is one of those things where you say, I don't like that. And if he supports that, then that could... That's not good. I don't want that. And, you know, we haven't checked this ad, but there are votes that the New Hampshire Democratic Party pointed to support their position, the Democrats' position, that Frank Ginta allowed the NSA to snoop on phone calls and passwords. Those are, you know, a couple votes that they have cited, H.R. 3309 back when he was in office.
Yeah,
and others.
I want to let everybody know, we talked to Mr. Ginta about this, I think it was last week.
Absolutely.
So if you want to check out that interview, we definitely did talk about this issue. We'll play more ads coming up and do a little fact checking. We'll also take your calls, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're taking a look at this year's political ads, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We want your thoughts about some of the ads that you're seeing and hearing this year. Do you find them amusing or annoying? Are there ads whose themes hit home for you, or do you disbelieve all of them? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, just before the break, we were playing an ad that showed how the issue of the NSA and privacy has come up in the first district race, not so much in the other races. Quick thoughts from you, Wayne Lesperance, and then I want to play some other ads.
Well, again, this is about, you know, trying to depict former Congressman Ginta as an unacceptable choice. I mean, what kind of judgment could he possibly be exercising when he wants employers to be able to get my Facebook ad? And, you know, when you dig a little bit deeper, you know, you can sort of try to see who are they targeting these ads towards. So, you know, there's a particular demographic that seems to be on Facebook all the time, right? And that's a demographic, relatively young voters, that you certainly want to get to turn out. But again, it's about this idea of drawing sharp distinctions between your candidate, you know, and the other candidate. And this is one that they decided was going to help them along those lines.
Let's go to our listeners. Gentlemen, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We want your thoughts, reactions to some of the campaign ads you've been seeing and hearing this year. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. And Nevin is in Hancock. Hi, Nevin. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. Go ahead, Nevin.
My wife and I picked up on a small trend in all these horrible ads that are on TV now. Scott Brown has an ad with his sister, and they talk about how they imply she was molested by a stepdad or something like that. And then Frank Ginta's got his mother and wife on an ad talking about cancer and heart attacks in the family and mental illness in the family. Like, since when do we broadcast that? You know, I mean, everybody's got mental illness in the family somewhere, but why would you I'm just curious about why you put that on TV. Does that make you more human? Or just a thought.
You know, Nevin, that's a really interesting point. Two questions there to you. First, Jonathan Van Fleet, bring out the family.
Sure. It humanizes the candidates. It personalizes them. They become less of the political machine and more of someone like your neighbor or someone who you might know. And you say, oh, I can relate to that. And so that is, you know, actually a positive ad where they're talking about themselves and their families and what they stand for. And those are effective, too.
Yeah, Nevin's right, though. I've noticed, Wayne, you know, people aren't just bringing out the family and here's my adorable children and, you know, my lovely husband or wife. But people are this year talking about some of the struggles in their families.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's really about making them much more human. Gosh, I mean, you can remember, you know, back in the time of Al and Tipper Gore that, you know, any kind of discussion of mental illness was considered taboo. Is it something you never would ever do? And I think that you see now a much more human face to that. And you know, and I think probably this is a good thing in society that we can have more of a conversation about it. I'm not sure in a 30-second political campaign ad that's the place to do it. But, you know, again, the goal is to make these folks seem as just as regular, you know, Joes and Janes, people that live next door, as they can. And so I suppose that's the idea.
Well, I want to ask about another theme that we've seen a lot of advertising about, not only on television, but boy, in my mailbox, I'm getting a lot of this. And Jonathan, this is a theme that worked well for Democrats in 2012. It's unclear how well it's going to work for them this year. I think you know what I'm going to say, the so-called war on women. How much of the advertising, just roughly, Jonathan, has been focused on this theme? Seems to me it's been a lot.
It has been a lot, and it really hit the Senate race big last week. That was at Jean Shaheen came out with an ad calling into question Scott Brown's support for women's reproductive rights. He immediately called a press conference. His wife, standing by his side, said, "This is a smear campaign. This is wrong. This is distorting my record." He came out with a counter ad the next day. It was a big deal. And then in the second congressional race, Ann Custer, ever since the primary night, she has been talking about Marilynda Garcia's record on women's issues and reproductive rights. And so she's been taking that to her from day one.
Okay, well, let's get into the U.S. Senate campaign, because you're right. It's been huge there. Here first is the Shaheen ad tackling Scott Brown's record on abortion.
I'm Jean Shaheen, and I approve this message.
On issues important to women, what's Scott Brown's record? In Massachusetts, Scott Brown pushed for a law to force women considering abortion, force them to look at color photographs of developing fetuses. Scott Brown wants the government to tell women how to make this decision.
Anti-choice groups. And again, you talked about that ad, Jonathan Van Fleet, and you guys fact-checked this. What sort of grade did this ad get?
This was a mostly true. And so that means there's an element of truth, but it needs some clarification. And this was not the most, how do I say it, there has to be a unanimous decision on this is the right ruling. And there was a lot of discussion on this one, because the Massachusetts bill that they point to as evidence of forcing women to see these photographs never uses the actual word force.
This is the Women's Right to Know Act,
yes.
A Massachusetts bill that Scott Brown co-sponsored back in 2003 when he was in the state Senate.
Go ahead. And thank you for the background. So, yes, it never uses the word force. What it does, require doctors to provide these photos to women. It requires them to give adoption agencies. It requires doctors to provide women with information about the different abortion procedures and some of the medical complications. It has a lot of different things in it. And among them are these photos or realistic drawings of fetuses at two-week periods during gestation. It also requires doctors to ask women before an abortion is performed, have you seen the information? And so that word seen, we thought, kind of put it, we're talking about photos, see with the eyes, have you seen the information? The doctor asks the woman, and then she has to affirmatively say yes or no, and then she has to sign a consent before the medical procedure is is performed.
But she still has a choice as to whether she wants to see them. And some doctors, you could imagine, Jonathan, would say, you know, I need to give you this information, but you don't really have to look at it.
Absolutely. So Scott Brown made the point that this information could be given to a woman, and she would turn around and throw it in the garbage can and never look at it. And that's certainly a possibility. Absolutely. But that question, have you seen the material? Have you seen the information? That woman is then faced to either lie to the doctor, no, I threw it. Yes, I did, but I really threw it in the garbage can, or no, I didn't.
So the Shaheen campaign, I mean, the bill was there. Scott Brown did support it back in 2003. On the other hand, the use of the word force, you guys rank that as...
Force. So that's it did just about everything except for have someone sit down and go over the photos with a woman. That's why this was rated mostly true.
Well, and as you said, Jonathan, the Brown camp had some concerns about this charge and came out very quickly with its own ad. Let's hear that.
You may have seen that Senator Shaheen is running an ad calling into question my support for women's health care. I want you to know the facts. I'm pro-choice. I support continued funding for Planned Parenthood, and I believe women should have access to contraception. After 6 years of voting with President Obama, Senator Shaheen has resorted to a smear campaign to distract voters from her record.
Okay, so Wayne L'Esperance, the so-called war on women, women voters, here we are again.
Right, we are. And I think that the explanation we just heard for this, which I think is exactly right, is part of why this is such an effective ad. The average person isn't going to have that explanation. The average person isn't going to hear the facts around the allegation and the response and all of that. They're going to hear an ad that calls into question whether or not Scott Brown really is as pro-choice as he claims to be. They're going to know that Scott Brown is part of a party that has historically not been pro-choice. And they're going to maybe know that the state party in New Hampshire, you know, changed its plank to go even further on a pro-life or anti-choice stance. Right. So, you know, this is why negative ads are so effective. Most people don't take the time to fact check. It's great that we have these folks out there doing this like Jonathan. But at the end of the day, they don't get all that. And really, the point of this ad has, in my view, less to do about a debate about abortion and more to do with getting women voters out to vote, particularly independents. This whole race comes down to those folks in the middle that are not unaligned, Republican or Democrat, who are trying to decide who they're going to vote for. And for Jean Shaheen, success is getting those folks to pull the lever with her name on it. And so what you can do is say, hey, look, Scott Brown may say he's pro-choice, but he may not really be. Look what he's done in the past. And he's part of a party that certainly isn't. You're safer. Your vote is safer. Your reproductive freedoms are safer by voting for Jean Shaheen. That's the argument they're going to make. And that's what this ad does very effectively in 30 seconds. And you know how I know this is true, Laura? How many days after that ad ran is Scott Brown still talking about this issue? He's playing defense, which means he's not playing offense out there pushing his own ideas and his own agenda. And that's the mark of a really effective ad.
Well, and at the tail end of that ad, we heard Scott Brown say, you know, Jean Shaheen votes with Obama 99% of the time. We've seen other ads, Wayne, against Democrats saying, you know, so-and-so is Obama's biggest supporter. What's the message there, and who are those ads targeting, Wayne?
Okay, so what we've seen across the country is a president with, you know, what we often call upside-down approval ratings. In other words, more negative than positive in terms of job approval for the president. So across the country in these key tight Senate races that are key to claiming control of the Senate for either party is in every instance, it seems, that they're connecting the Democrats to the president. So there are the ads about the 99% voting record with the president. The idea is that voters are unhappy with the president. This is the last chance they'll ever get it to vote against him, even though he's not on the ballot, to push back against his party, to hold them accountable for their frustration with the president. And so this has been a consistent theme since day one. Candidates are linking the Democratic incumbents or challengers to the president. And to the extent that that resonates with particularly independent voters, that's going to get, you know, they're hoping will yield success for them. It's also a way of rallying the base, getting the base excited to turn out. Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later, but this idea of an enthusiasm gap that Republicans are more excited about Election Day than Democrats are, and that could lead to greater turnout for Republicans. So you kind of want to keep reminding them that the for Republicans and for independents, maybe leaning Republican, that, you know, Barack Obama is on the ballot in his own way through his party, and this is a chance to vote against him.
That's interesting.
That's the idea, yeah.
So it's not just about getting out that small independent slice, Wayne. It's about energizing your base with that Obama 99% of the time.
That's right. Absolutely.
How much are you seeing President Obama presented in these ads this year, Jonathan, even though he's not on the ballot officially?
Okay. So he's not on the ballot, but he has said that his policies are, that this election is definitely about his policies. And so if the president has a negative approval rating, if you can tie an incumbent Democrat to the president and his policies, you might be able to eke out that election. You might be able to chip away and get a win.
So that's why we keep seeing ads that show Obama, even though he's not officially. You're not going to be able to check for or against him.
Absolutely. So whether it be Ann Custer, Carol Shea Porter, Jean Shaheen, all of them, they agree. You'll hear the ads that say they agree with Nancy Pelosi. They agree with Barack Obama 99% of the time, 100% of the time. These staggering numbers that you think, wow, you know, are they just a rubber stamp for the president and these unpopular policies? But generally, there's a layer of truth beneath that. But if you say, again, these negative ads, if you say it enough times, it sinks in. Even if people are trying to ignore it, it reaches that collective consciousness.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, I want to play one more ad. You mentioned Jonathan Van Fleet, President Obama's policies, and certainly a biggie, maybe even the biggie, is the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. Let's hear an ad now in the first congressional district. This one is aimed at Carol Shea Porter. We played an ad earlier aimed at Frank Inta. Here's the Carol Shea Porter ad.
I'm Helen DePrima. When we lost our secondary health care plan because of Obamacare, we were shocked. Carol Shea Porter said, if you like your coverage, you can keep it. It wasn't true. Now my out-of-pocket costs for prescriptions are much higher. Some of my medications may not be covered. Obamacare isn't working for us.
So again, that's an ad, Jonathan Van Fleet. Do you know who happened to know? I think that was an Americans for Prosperity
ad. It was.
Ad.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that, that is also a stylized ad. It's an actual New Hampshire person looking directly at the camera, talking about how Obamacare doesn't work for them. And coincidentally, repeats the PolitiFact lie of the year, which is you can keep your health care if you want to. That turned out famously to be absolutely not true. And so she's saying that I wanted to keep my health care plan. My secondary plan was canceled. It's put me in the lurch. I might be paying more. Obamacare has been bad for me. So you're attaching Carol Shea Porter to Obamacare, which many people hate. And so therefore, if you can attach those two things, therefore, you can get some leverage.
So the PolitiFact lie of the year is?
You can keep your health care plan if you want to.
Because that hasn't worked out in New Hampshire.
It hasn't worked out across the country that certain plans were denied.
I'm wondering, Wayne L'Esperance, if we were to travel to five other states, if we would see very similar ads to the one we just heard against the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, you will. I mean, and it'll be often the very exact same script, just different faces. Over the summer, I spent some time down in Virginia, and I saw the very same ads with just different, you know, different faces involved. A little bit more of a Southern accent than a New Hampshire accent. but it's a national argument, right? And frankly, I guess I'd say that one of the things that surprises me about this cycle is that healthcare hasn't been as dominant an issue as I thought it might be. I think that when you look at sort of the president's numbers, you see them begin to trend down as Obamacare gets rolled out, especially here in New Hampshire. And so, you know, there seems to be a connection between voter dissatisfaction and Obamacare. And yet it hasn't been the overarch dominant, you know, campaign message, in my opinion, that I thought it would be, you know, even a year ago. So, you know, it's definitely a national piece. You hear it all across the country. But it's one of many different kinds of attacks that we're seeing made against the Democrats.
Now, why do you think, Wayne, that it hasn't been as dominant as you thought it would be?
I think that they've transitioned from focusing on healthcare to focusing on the president's negative numbers. And so when you see those numbers, you then say, okay, let me tie every Democrat to the president. The president's unpopular, then these folks can become unpopular by association. So that's where the 99% voting records and things like that come up.
Jonathan, I know we have to let you go in a couple minutes. Other ads that have really either caught your attention or really stood out in terms of what you guys call pants on fire, or just what you expect, you know, as these next 3 weeks roll out.
Back to Scott Brown's ad, one of the things that he said at the very end of that ad is, I support continued funding for Planned Parenthood. So there's a statement, and when we're looking at things to fact check, so if he's talking about his support for something now, you know, that's difficult to fact check. But we are looking into that claim because Emily's List, which supports female Democratic pro-choice candidates, has basically pointed to Scott Brown's vote on House Resolution 1 in 2011, which would have partially defunded Planned Parenthood. So we're looking at that. There are so many ads going back to the beginning of the show that there aren't enough of us to check all of this.
Well, that's the thing. You must feel totally overwhelmed. I mean, how do you even start?
Well, we try and pick the things that make us stop and go, wow, I wonder if that's true. You know, just using that old human curiosity aspect, and also looking where, you know, at the ads that are really kind of getting the airwaves going, that are getting people talking, and that's where we begin our work.
Well, I really appreciate you talking with us today, Jonathan. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Jonathan Van Fleet, Managing Editor for Content at the Telegraph of Nashua, Editor of PolitiFact, New Hampshire. Wayne Lesperance is staying with us because coming up in the next 20 minutes, we're going to be taking a look at something else a lot of voters say they don't like about campaigns, and that's the polls. Andy Smith, too, from the UNH Survey Center will be with us. So we'll talk about polling in just a moment. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In this last segment of our hour on The Exchange today, we're going to look at polling and how it's being done in this campaign season. With us for the hour is Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement, which includes the New England College Polling Institute. And also with us on the phone is Andy Smith, professor of political science at UNH, director of the UNH Survey Center. And Andy Smith, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good morning.
Well, both of you, but I think I'll start with you, Andy. We always get a lot of questions from people about how you guys do what you do. Just give us a basic primer of how you even get started, Andy, in figuring out how voters might really vote.
Well, first off, you have to look at the political science literature that's got now going back 40, 50 years about the reasons people vote, and or also the reasons people don't vote. Look at the history of that. And one of the things that we definitely know in polling is that people overestimate their intentions of voting. The biggest problem that political scientists have found, public opinion researchers have found in polling, is trying to figure out who's going to show up. Asking people who they're going to vote for is fairly straightforward, but trying to figure out who's going to show up is the hardest thing. And that's especially hard because voting is seen as a good thing in our country. And people, I would say, overestimate their intentions of voting. I won't say they lie about it, but they overestimate their intentions.
Wow, so, that's interesting. So hang on. So people say, you know, you call them and you ask them, you say, you likely to vote this year? And they say, oh, yeah. And then you say, who I'm going to vote for. But you're saying, maybe not all the time.
Not all the time, but significantly. Most of the time, you'll get it, especially in a midterm election. In midterm elections like this, in presidential elections, New Hampshire has pretty high turnout, 70 to 80%, one of the top four or five states in the country. But in midterm elections, we're pretty mediocre, middle of the pack, 40%, 42% turnout. So that means of the people that we talk to, trying to figure out who's going to show up actually is the hardest thing to do. And we ask several questions to try to make it easier for people to tell us they're not going to do it, but we also know that we're overestimating that. The second problem is that in New Hampshire, the laws here are such that it's very easy for people to actually show up and vote. You don't have to be registered in advance. You can just show up on election day and say you're a resident and want to vote. So you don't want to systematically exclude people who may be walk-up voters, same-day registrants, by relying on past voters or lists of people who were registered to vote, because you'll systematically exclude anywhere between 5 and 15% of that day's voters. So it's a tough thing to do to figure out who's going to vote. That's, to me, the hardest problem in pre-election polling.
Well, sure. And we had a caller, actually, who couldn't stay on with us, but she wanted to know, who do pollsters actually talk to? She said so many people hang up. Guilty as charged. Sorry, Andy and Wayne, but, you know, I'm busy. I'm making dinner. I'm dealing with my kids' homework or something. Wayne, what about that? Who do you end up talking to, given that so many people, like me, are busy and we hang up? We don't have time.
Sure. Well, we begin with, you know, lists. We do begin with lists of registered voters, right? And we do ask about intentionality, as Andy mentioned. I think our first question is, are you likely to vote? You know, somewhat likely, in all of those different categories, and try to get a sense of the likelihood of the person is to vote. So, in our case, if you're a registered voter in New Hampshire, you'll appear on a list, and you know, we randomly select those folks. And we call out to them. And so that's the criteria. So if you're not registered, Andy's right. If you're not registered, if you want to show up and vote same day or register very late, there's a good chance you're not going to be on our caller list.
So is there a certain demographic? I'll turn to you first, Wayne, but Andy, I want to hear from you too. Is there a certain demographic, Wayne, that is more likely to hang up and therefore your results are skewed?
Well, that's a real challenge. I mean, which is why we try to collect as much demographic data as we can to get a good sense of who exactly did we get responses from. We know in demographically who's more likely to vote, folks who tend to be older. We know at least that some of the literature tells us that women are more likely to respond to a poll than men are. People who are, it varies from age groups. So I'm not sure that there's a clear picture on that. But certainly our goal is to try to mirror the population in terms of our demographics for the results that we come up with.
Okay, so recognizing that's a problem, you try to statistically correct for it. Andy Smith, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, again, that is the problem, trying to figure out getting the people who are at home. And we do know that older people are at home more often than younger people, and they're more likely to talk on the telephone than our younger people who are busier. We also know that women are more likely to answer the phone and talk with the interviewer than our men. And there are things that you can do to make sure that you don't have that problem or minimize that problem. First thing you have to do is randomly select a person from within a household. So if you're calling a household and there are two or three registered voters or people who could be likely voters, you can't just talk to the first person who answers the phone, because that's typically going to be an older woman, probably the mother in the household. And you have to randomly select an individual from within the household to speak to, otherwise you get a biased sample. But in midterm elections, we do know that younger people are less likely to vote. And that is a problem. But in presidential elections, one of the methodological things that you get very concerned about, and this happened to Gallup and a number of the other polls, and it happens with the IVR, the interactive voice response polls, is that they can't call cell phones. And we do know that younger people are more likely to be in cell phone only households. So you have to be careful about whether or not you're systematically excluding people from voting simply because they don't have a landline phone. So again, these methodological issues are tough, but when you get down to a well-constructed survey that has a broad sampling frame, most of the research indicates that the people who don't respond don't do so because they're busy. It wasn't a convenient time. So multiple callbacks are one way to get around that. So unfortunately, we call people households back up to 8 times.
So it was you ringing my phone yesterday.
Yeah, and if we identify a randomly selected person within the household, we'll call them back up to another 8 times. So we want to really really work the sample as hard as we can so we aren't systematically excluding people just because we caught them at an inconvenient time.
You can exclude me, Andy, if you want. I won't be hurt.
No, we're going to put you on our special.
Yeah, right. Well, and I want to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, your questions and comments about polling this year, how it's evolving and changing, 1-800-892-6477. So an important point that you just made, Andy, that I want to ask both of you about. Wayne, you first. Cell phones. I mean, a lot of people, not just younger people, although certainly more of them, are completely dropping landline coverage. How does your polling at New England College deal with that? Can you call cell phones?
We can't. We can't. Right now, there's what I would describe as a rather antiquated law that prevents, because we do use the automated call system. And so as a result, we can't call those cell phone numbers. So Andy's right. We are missing out on a demographic. And so our way of trying to work around that is to make sure that our sample size is large, to make sure that we have a good sense of having reached that particular demographic through landlines. But, you know, this is an ongoing concern that I think a lot of folks, national polling organizations, would love to see these laws change and are working hard to that end. But you know, as the premise of the show began, folks aren't huge fans of polls. And so, you know, one of the things they love to hate is the, you know, that call at supper time, you know, from a pollster. So how successful they'll be in changing those laws, I don't know, but it is a challenge that we face. And you know, it's something that we are, you know, very mindful of as we work. The other workaround we have, Laura, is that because we're automated, because it's less expensive, frankly, to run the polls the way we do it, we can do more polls. And so since primary day, we've been running a poll a week. And that allows us to get, I think, a bigger picture of what's going on in the political landscape because we have more, you know, samples, more polls to work from.
So you can sort of look at polls and bumps over time.
Right, trends. Right.
Yeah. So, okay, so how about the UNH Survey Center, Andy? Can you guys call cell phones?
Yes, we do. We call about 60% of the numbers that are included in our original sample are cell phone numbers. They're harder to reach cell phone numbers. They're more expensive to call them. We typically, it takes about twice as many contacts or twice as many calls to complete an interview with a cell phone versus a landline phone. So it does raise the cost, but again, we don't systematically exclude those people. And that's an important thing, I believe, because as we found out in 2012, the polls that weren't calling cell phones systematically underestimated the percentage of younger people, as well as the percentage of minorities and people living in cities who were included in their samples, and it skewed the results that they had because of that. Now, New Hampshire does not have a high percentage of cell phone only households compared with the country. Our cell phone only households are somewhere in the 18 to 20% rate. Unfortunately, we're about a year behind in terms of where we are now versus what the most recent or the most up-to-date information we have about that, which comes from it comes from the federal government health surveys. But we try to do that, and it is more difficult, more costly to get those people. But again, you don't want to systematically exclude people. And I do want to make one point about something that Wayne said, is that there is really no law of large numbers when it comes to surveys. Sampling error is based only on the number of people you interview, but it only works if you assume a random sample, and it only assumes that you have a random sample of the population that you're interested in, which in this case is likely voters. So surveys with really large numbers are not more accurate, and I think the classic example of that is the Literary Digest survey of 1936, which interviewed more than 2 million people and predicted that Alf Landon would be the president of the United States. And we don't talk about the Landon presidency very much.
Well,
so the margin of sampling error that we hear about is probably the least important source of error in surveys.
I've got a couple emails I want to share with both of you guys, but really, maybe this is a dumb question, Andy, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How come you guys can call cell phones and Wayne can't?
It's a legal issue. Basically, when you call a cell phone, you're making a collect call. Because we do in the United States have caller and the receiver pay when you get a call. Now, we don't see it necessarily because we have minutes and they're kind of disguised, but it is based on the premise that when you call somebody on a cell phone, it's a collect call.
So I still don't understand why you can and Wayne can't.
It's a federal law that part of the Telecommunications Act, I believe, of 2004. I may be wrong on the date, but it prevents, it was designed to prevent people who had cell phones from getting marketing calls, particularly from companies that would have automated marketing calls to them. So you can call it if you have a live interviewer.
You can't
do it if you have a computer that's making the call.
I see. Okay. Did you want to jump in there real quick, Wayne? Then I've got a couple emails.
Just to say that that's exactly right, that polls, surveys are lumped in with, you know, telemarketing calls. And if people buy their cell phone time by the number of minutes, that then technically, you know, we're using their time. They're paying for us to call them, and that's That was part of the challenge.
I see. So a real live person can do it, but an automated robocall can't.
Right. Right.
Okay. Here's an email from Peg in Bedford. I'll throw this to you, Wayne, maybe. If the caller says he or she does not answer polls and please remove the number from the calling list, do pollsters honor that? Wayne?
We do. So after we identify ourselves right at the beginning of our automated poll, we give our phone number and our website. And after any given poll, we'll have a number of calls, messages waiting for us asking to be removed, and we dutifully remove them.
Yeah. Andy, how about you?
Yeah, we do. We're not required to, actually. That's one of the misconceptions people have, because political surveys for public opinion are not considered market research. There's a special carve-out in the federal legislation. So we are not obliged to honor that, but we certainly do. We don't want to make sure – we want to make sure as an industry that we're not aggravating people. So if someone asks to be put on our do-not-call list, we absolutely do that.
All right, Peg, thanks for the email. And here's another one from BJ in Sullivan, who says, I've gotten two push-poll phone surveys recently, one for Gene Shaheen and one for Scott Brown. They start out like normal surveys, but after a while start giving very negative comments or, quote, facts about a candidate, and then ask if this makes you more or less likely to vote for them. BJ says, I found both of these surveys to be very obnoxious and disturbing, and even though I am strongly for one of those candidates, he says, how can we protect ourselves from these push polls? I wish they could be outlawed. Now, this is a big deal, guys, right? I mean, from what I understand, Andy Smith, push polls are supposedly outlawed in New Hampshire, aren't they?
They are, but what I think the caller, the emailer is describing is not something that is outlawed. There are two kinds of polls that we consider push polls, and they get blurred in people's mind.
The first is typically
a very short survey, in which an interviewer, either a live interviewer or more likely a computer, calls up and says they're going to do a poll, but it immediately goes into negative information, and they don't really ask you any information about who you're going to vote for, any demographic information. It's really just another way to market a candidate, in this case, negatively market a candidate. That said, however, campaigns need to know what their strengths and weaknesses are and what the strengths and weaknesses are of their opponents. So they routinely make these calls where they ask things or they provide information that is negative about either themselves or their opponent to see how that might impact the way the voter goes. And these are not illegal, I think the way that you can tell the difference between these is that they tend to be longer, they tend to be with live interviewers doing the work on it, and also they tend, if you look at the overall number of people that are called, they tend to be fairly small in number because it's expensive to do polling. And if you want to just try to convince people to vote against a candidate one way or the other, it's much cheaper and much more effective simply to buy advertising.
Yeah, BJ, it's a good question. Wayne, so you guys at NEC and UNH aren't doing push polling. That's done by the campaigns themselves, right?
No, absolutely not. Our goal is simply, it's scientific research. Our goal is to get a snapshot of the electorate, you know, on any given day when we run this poll, to get a sense of where they are and candidates are on issues.
So, Wayne, from what I understand, you guys have some new polls out just today. I mean, we've talked mostly about polls and how you folks do it, but what's the latest in terms of results?
Well, probably the race that most folks are focusing on is the U.S. Senate race, and for the first time in our poll, it's still a statistical tie, but we have Scott Brown actually up over Gene Shaheen, 48% to 46.9%. I think, interestingly, in all of our races, we're calling them margin of error races. I mean, they're very, very close, which leads us to believe that come Election Day, voters are going to have have a real impact, those who turn out.
All four of the races are margin of error races, or just the three, two for Congress and one for U.S. Senate?
Two for Congress, one for U.S. Senate. The governor's race is Maggie Hassan has just over a five-point lead over Walt Havenstein, which is just outside of the MOE.
Andy, real quickly, because we're getting close to the end, what are you seeing? Are some of these races what Wayne called margin of error races?
I think they are too close to call. I think that the governor's race might be the only one that is going to break a little bit earlier. But let me make one other point about margin of error. When people see a margin of sampling error, it's very important that they understand that they have to add and subtract that margin of sampling error from both estimates. So if a candidate's leading by 5 percentage points and the margin of error is 4 percentage points, for that candidate to have a statistical lead, they have to be about 8 percentage points ahead of their opponent.
Wow. It's a big, big split there. Okay. Both of you, thank you very much for being with us. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again before Election Day. Andy Smith, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Andy Smith, professor of political science at UNH, director of the UNH Survey Center. Wayne L'Esperance, great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Laura. My pleasure.
Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement, which includes the New England College Polling Institute. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel, with help from Melanie Plenda. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.